believe the bullet that shattered Connolly's rib and wrist was the same one that struck JFK in the back. Noted forensic pathologist Cyril Wecht shared that conclusion when he served on the forensic pathology panel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1978. JFK's two closest aides, Dave Powers and Kenny O'Donnell, both riding in the limousine behind JFK's, said that two shots came from the right front of the motorcade, the area of the grassy knoll with its picket fence, and many other witnesses in Dealey Plaza also saw or heard shots from that area. These witnesses included Abraham Zapruder, who made the famous film of the assassination, standing to the left and in front of the grassy knoll, and who testified that he thought the shots came from back of me. According to investigative journalist Anthony Summers, a dozen people were actually on the grassy knoll when the president was shot, and almost all of them believed some of the gunfire came from behind them, high up on the knoll itself, though many were never called by the Warren Commission. He notes that even 16 people in or outside the book depository indicated some shooting came from the knoll. While the number of shots claimed by all the known Dealey Plaza witnesses ranged from 2 to 5, in 1966 author Josiah Thompson found that, with no exceptions, all those witnesses who were deep inside the depository, either at work or in hallways, report hearing fewer than 3 shots, either just 1 shot or 2. When single bullet theory supporters claim that most people in Dealey Plaza heard 3 shots and that they came from the book depository, they're including witnesses such as Powers and O'Donnell, who later admitted that they were pressured to change their testimony. It's important to remember, while listening to this book, that even before the release of 4.5 million pages of files, author Henry Hurt discovered in 1986 that at least 60 witnesses claimed that the FBI in some way altered what the witnesses had reported. Many more such claims have emerged since then, and the witness intimidation alteration always favored the theory, stated as fact by the FBI within hours of the crime, that Oswald was the lone assassin. JFK's autopsy records and clothes show that his back wound was almost 6 inches below his collar. Even the 1964 attempt to restage the shooting by the FBI, which always slanted its investigation toward Oswald as a single assassin, depicted the wound on its test subject accurately, about 6 inches below the collar. The Warren volumes even included a photo of that FBI reenactment with the back wound accurately placed, yet the commission ignored it when adopting the single-bullet theory. Any bullet fired from the 6th floor of the book depository that entered JFK's back would have been traveling downward at a steep angle. Yet, for the lone nut magic bullet theory to work, that same bullet had to cause the wound just below JFK's Adam's apple, a wound that is significantly higher than the wound in JFK's back. Even if the bullet somehow ricocheted off one of JFK's bones, theoretically turning upward to exit JFK's throat, it would have been impossible for the bullet to change course in midair to dive down to hit Connolly. In 1997, Warren Commissioner Gerald Ford admitted to the Associated Press that he had changed the description of the back wound in the Warren report into a back-of-the-neck wound. Raising the back wound almost 6 inches made the single-bullet theory appear more viable. Anyone can disprove the single-bullet theory by simply sitting a person, preferably a 6-foot-tall male, in a chair. With your test subject in a chair, measure 6 inches below the top of his collar and put a mark there. Then put another small mark just below his Adam's apple. You don't even need to figure the exact downward angle of the bullet, which is a matter of some debate. The autopsy physician who probed JFK's back wound said the downward angle was 45 to 60 degrees, but all experts agree that the angle was downward at least 15 to 20 degrees, possibly much more. On a normal-sized adult male, the wound just under the Adam's apple would be significantly higher than a back wound almost 6 inches below the collar. Thus, the single-bullet theory is physically impossible and should rightly be called the magic bullet theory. Historian Gerald D. McKnight points out, A theory is a well-supported and well-tested hypothesis or set of hypotheses, but the Warren Commission's one-bullet construction never met these demanding standards. It was an ad hoc invention or fabrication to meet the Commission's requirements for a lone assassin, no conspiracy explanation of the Kennedy assassination. Since that's the case, this book will henceforth refer to the almost pristine bullet as the magic bullet. Dr. McKnight devoted many pages of his acclaimed Warren Commission critique, Breach of Trust, to the many other reasons the magic bullet theory is impossible. Some of this information comes from files unavailable until recent years, but most of it has been known for decades, yet ignored or glossed over by magic bullet theorists. One obvious disproof of the magic bullet theory is visible to anyone watching the Zapruder film. Notice JFK, when he emerges from behind a sign, clearly shot in the throat as he raises his arms to his neck. At that exact instant, and for several moments more, John Connolly is seen just as clearly holding his white Stetson hat with his right hand, even though the magic bullet has supposedly already smashed his rib and shattered his right wrist. In addition, doctors testified that more small bullet fragments were removed from Connolly's wounds than were missing from the almost pristine bullet. The amount of material missing from the magic bullet was about the weight of a postage stamp, far less than the weight of those bullet fragments. As for JFK's throat wound, the Dallas doctors called it a small wound of entrance, meaning JFK was shot from the front. Chapter 16 explains how that tiny 3 to 5 millimeter neat entrance wound seen by the Dallas doctors became the much larger jagged wound seen in JFK's Bethesda autopsy photos. Since the Bethesda doctors couldn't find a bullet while probing JFK's back wound during the autopsy, they were relieved to hear that the almost pristine magic bullet had been found in Dallas. However, Dr. David Osborne, later an admiral and deputy surgeon general of the Navy, told congressional investigators that he saw an intact bullet roll onto the autopsy table when JFK was first removed from his casket, before the start of the official autopsy. "I had that bullet in my hand and looked at it," he said, "and it was reasonably clean and unmarred, but the Secret Service took it." An X-ray technician at the autopsy also saw a pretty good-sized bullet when we lifted JFK up. That's when it came out. The commanding officer of the Naval Medical School at the time, Captain John Stover, told two authors, "There was a bullet in the Bethesda morgue." However, the magic bullet wasn't at Bethesda, but many miles away at the FBI laboratory. Like so much other crucial evidence, including JFK's brain, the Bethesda bullet vanished from the official record, for reasons explained in later chapters. FBI and other scientific claims that the magic bullet could be matched to the same batch of ammunition as the bullet fragments found in JFK's limo were finally debunked to the scientific community in 2007 by Texas A&M researchers Cliff Spiegelman and Dennis James. When the Army provided the Warren Commission with its top wound ballistic expert, Dr. Joseph R. Dolce, he and his associate, Dr. Frederick Light, Jr., said that the magic bullet couldn't have shattered Connolly's wrist and still retained its virtually pristine condition. When they fired Oswald's actual Mannlicher Carcano into 10 cadaver wrists, in each and every instance the bullet was markedly deformed and not pristine. Dolce and his tests were not mentioned in the Warren report. Instead, Warren Commission Assistant Counsel Arlen Specter, the creator of the magic bullet theory, relied on a veterinarian's tests, which involved shooting into horse meat, gelatin blocks, and goat carcasses to prove his theory. Decades later, a wound ballistics expert said he was finally able to produce a relatively unmarred bullet after firing into a cadaver's wrist, but only by reducing the bullet's speed by half and not firing it through a rib first. In a desperate attempt to make the magic bullet theory work, some authors claim that JFK was leaning very far forward in his seat or had his suit coat and shirt greatly bunched up along the back of his head. but photos and the Zapruder film show that that was clearly not the case. The bunching was minor, which is why the wound in the autopsy drawing and photograph lined up perfectly with the bullet holes in JFK's shirt and suit coat, all almost 6 inches below the top of the collar. When computer animation was used in a major television special to try to make the magic bullet theory work, JFK's neck and shoulders were so distorted that he almost didn't look human. In one Discovery Channel special, not one of mine, when JFK's shooting was restaged accurately, it showed that the bullet striking JFK in the back would have exited through his heart, not just below his Adam's apple. In addition, that Discovery crew had trouble getting its Mannlicher Carcano rifle to fire, even though it had been worked on by a top gunsmith, unlike Oswald's cheap mail-order rifle. The problem wasn't just the rifle's age, since a 1967 special by CBS had the same problems, even though CBS used a rifle that fired faster and was in better condition than Oswald's weapon. More than a third of the attempts had to be disqualified, because of trouble with the rifle, as documented by author Michael T. Griffith. Not only that, but in the case of CBS, not one of the 11 participating expert marksmen scored at least 2 hits, as the magic bullet theory requires, on his first attempt. A majority, 7 of them, failed to do so on any of their attempts. Oswald would have had only 1 attempt. Accounts supporting the magic bullet theory and Oswald as the lone assassin usually mention that Oswald earned a rating of marksman when he was in the Marines, leaving the impression that he was a crack shot. That's an important part of the magic bullet lone nut theory, since in all the years since the assassination, no sharpshooter has ever duplicated the shooting attributed to Oswald on his first try and with an accurate moving target. However, the reality is that marksman is the lowest of the 3 Marine shooting titles. The lowest possible score on the test is 190, with the highest rating 250. In other words, almost anyone could get a score of at least 190 and be considered a marksman on that test. Before Oswald left the Marines, he scored only 1 point above the minimum, and sometimes missed not just the bullseye, but the entire target. Finally, the evidence is clear that the magic bullet was not even found on Governor Connally's stretcher. At Dallas's Parkland Hospital, an hour and 15 minutes after JFK was shot, senior engineer Daryl Tomlinson found the nearly pristine bullet. It was on one of 2 stretchers close together in a hallway, one of which had probably been used to transport Connally. The other hadn't been used for either Kennedy or Connally, but instead for either a female adult patient who had been bleeding from the mouth or a 2-and-a-half-year-old patient with a deep cut on his chin. Tomlinson initially told Arl Inspector that he had found the bullet on the stretcher that had not held Connally. But after being pressured and intimidated by Spector to reverse his testimony, Tomlinson claimed uncertainty, still refusing to say the bullet came from Connally's stretcher. However, Dr. McKnight's recent analysis of the testimony of Parkland nurse Jane C. Wester and orderly R. J. Jameson corroborates Tomlinson's initial statement and strongly supported the conclusion that the bullet had not been found on Connally's stretcher. Both stretchers had probably been unattended for 30 minutes in a hall where various people were milling about. The non-Connally stretcher might have had enough bloodstains to cause a person to think it had been Connally's or even Kennedy's stretcher. Someone could have easily planted the magic bullet to incriminate Oswald. Around 1:30 p.m., about 15 minutes before the magic bullet was discovered, 2 reliable witnesses at Parkland Hospital saw Jack Ruby, a lower-level member of Carlos Marcello's organization. One of the 2 witnesses, journalist Seth Cantor, even spoke to Ruby, as he later told authorities and confirmed to me. However, Ruby later lied to authorities about the encounter, saying that he hadn't gone to Parkland that day. That raises the question of why Ruby would deny his presence there, unless he was engaged in some illegal activity, such as planting evidence. Ruby might have planted the magic bullet or might have given it to someone else to plant. Regardless of who placed the pristine bullet on the non-Connally stretcher, It was used to link Oswald's rifle to the shooting of JFK and Connolly. Since the Warren Commission's version of the magic bullet theory is impossible to physically support, and since someone planted the bullet to incriminate Oswald, and much evidence and testimony shows that there were at least two shooters, where does that leave the Warren Report's lone nut scenario? The Warren Report went out of its way to stress that Oswald's commitment to Marxism and communism appears to have been another important factor in his motivation to kill President Kennedy. The commission related information saying that Oswald had become a Marxist communist when he was a teenager and had continued a fascination with Russia when he joined the United States Marines. According to the official story, after getting an early discharge by claiming he needed to financially provide for his mother, he defected to Russia in 1959. After marrying a Russian woman, Marina Prusakova, he returned to the United States in 1962. He worked at a photographic map firm in Dallas in the fall and moved to New Orleans in the spring to live with his uncle. After ordering the rifle and pistol he would allegedly use on November 22, 1963. Marina eventually joined him in New Orleans, where he worked for a relatively short time at a coffee company, before being unemployed during August 1963. In that month, he got a surprising amount of publicity for his local chapter of the pro-Castro Fair Play for Cuba Committee. After sending Marina and their child to live with a friend in Dallas, Oswald made a mysterious trip to Mexico City, visiting the Russian and Cuban embassies there, before heading to Dallas himself. He lived for a time in a Dallas YMCA before moving to a rooming house in the Oak Cliff section of the city, visiting Marina on the weekends. He also got a job at the Texas School Book Depository, one of dozens of tall buildings that overlooked JFK's planned motorcade route. From there, according to the Warren Report, he alone would shoot JFK and soon after kill Dallas patrolman J.D. Tippit. From teenage communist to presidential assassin and murderer, Oswald's story was readily accepted by an American audience in the middle of the Cold War, just 1 year after the tense nuclear showdown with Russia during the Cuban Missile Crisis. For decades, authors ranging from Gerald Posner to Bill O'Reilly have repeated and expanded on this version of the story. However, questions about that scenario and Oswald's motivation, or lack of it, surfaced soon after his murder by Jack Ruby, and they've been growing ever since. The Warren Report's depiction of Oswald as a teenage Marxist who grew into a troubled, murderous loner doesn't stand up to modern scrutiny. In addition to the Warren Commission's report and 26 volumes of evidence, thousands of additional pages of Warren Commission documents were eventually released. These make it clear that the FBI, and especially Naval Intelligence and the CIA, withheld much crucial information about Oswald. Today we have thousands of pages of additional material from the House Select Committee's investigation, and those have been supplemented by millions of pages of additional files. These documents helped to cast Oswald in a very different light. It's shockingly easy to debunk the Warren Report depiction of Oswald as a teenage Marxist. How many teenage Marxists joined the Civil Air Patrol as Oswald did, especially in the McCarthy era? How many teenage Marxists in the 1950s joined the U.S. Marines? Oswald had even been so desperate to join that he tried to enlist before he was legally old enough. How many U.S. Marines in the conservative Nixon-McCarthy 50s were, like Oswald, allegedly going around his base publicly spouting a supposed love of all things Russian and allegedly teaching himself to speak fluent Russian? Even the Warren Report admits that his fellow Marines called him Oswaldskovich. Yet not once was Oswald ever written up or disciplined for his outrageously pro-Russian behavior, not even when he was based at the sensitive U-2 spy plane base in Atsugi, Japan. G. Robert Blakey, the former mafia prosecutor for Robert Kennedy, who directed the House Select Committee on Assassinations, repeatedly asked during a PBS interview, "Why was no action taken against him? Why, when this came to the attention of his Marine superiors, was action not initiated? This man was a man with a security clearance. This man was a man who had access to highly sophisticated materials, and he is now showing an interest in Marxism. Blakey was right to be concerned, since Oswald had been a radar operator for the Marines at Atsugi, where the CIA's super-secret U-2 spy planes were based for their flights over Russia. Even more bizarre, soon after defector Oswald made a well-publicized 1962 return to the United States with a Russian wife in tow, U.S. authorities allowed him to get a job at a Dallas firm that made maps from U-2 spy plane photos for the U.S. government at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The firm made the lettering used on the large display maps shown in televised presentations by U.S. officials, including President Kennedy. The Warren, Posner, Bugliosi, O'Reilly version asks us to believe that the FBI and CIA saw no problem with former defector Oswald working at the U-2 map firm at that dangerous time. Yet, later congressional investigations showed that that was a time when thousands of American communists, leftists, socialists, progressives, and liberals in non-sensitive jobs were routinely subjected to domestic surveillance. Oswald's actions make perfect sense only when viewed in light of all the facts, not just a select few. To be fair, it's also easier to evaluate Oswald accurately now that we're decades removed from the Cold War and the better dead than red mindset of many, if not most, Americans of the early 1960s. Before Oswald was born, his father died. He looked up to his older brothers, both of whom joined the military, with one serving in an intelligence service that ferreted out communists. Oswald's favorite TV show when he was young was I Led Three Lives, based on a true story about a seemingly ordinary American who went under deep cover for years as an apparent communist, only to emerge to fame and fortune when it was revealed that he was really a U.S. government agent. Oswald had an above-average IQ, but learning disabilities apparently hindered his schooling, so his prospects were limited. He grew up in less savory parts of New Orleans, where his mother knew members of the Marcello crime organization, and where his only father figure was a favorite uncle, Dutz Murat, who worked as a bookie for Marcello. Oswald's limited options apparently led him to follow in the footsteps of the protagonist of I Led Three Lives. And there is a great deal of evidence, including statements from fellow Marines, that he was recruited by military intelligence while in the Marines. Oswald told a fellow Marine that he had a civilian intelligence contact at the Atsugo U-2 base, who was believed to be in with the CIA. Also, author Dick Russell points out that when Oswald went to Russia in 1959, he was one of seven young men who defected around the same time, and six of those later returned to the United States with Russian wives. For years, the CIA denied debriefing Oswald when he returned to the United States, even though the agency routinely debriefed other, far less potentially damaging travelers to Russia. After all, Oswald did have high security clearances in the Marines. Wouldn't the CIA want to at least ask Oswald if he shared any information with the Soviets? Years later, after decades of denial, former CIA Director Richard Helms admitted to historian and retired military intelligence major John Newman that Oswald had been debriefed by the CIA. Helms and other officials had lied about that to government committees from the Warren Commission to the House Select Committee on Assassinations. But why? Bill O'Reilly's book, Killing Kennedy, acknowledges that an unusual Dallas man, an erudite and sophisticated anti-communist white Russian named George de Morenschild, helped Oswald get his job at the U-2 map firm in Dallas. But O'Reilly leaves out the well-documented fact that de Morenschild was an admitted and well-documented CIA asset who was in contact with the head of the CIA office in Dallas about Oswald's activities. As I first disclosed in 2005, using information mostly withheld from the House Select Committee on Assassinations, Oswald was under tight surveillance by naval intelligence from the time he returned to Russia until he was arrested for JFK's murder. According to my source, who helped file reports of that surveillance, the CIA assisted in tracking Oswald's movements and associates, as at times did the FBI. In addition, one of Oswald's files prominently included a CIA phone number to call in case he was ever in trouble, indicating that the CIA was utilizing or planning to utilize Oswald in some fashion. The monitoring of Oswald couldn't be obvious because Naval Intelligence wanted to see how the KGB might try to recruit Oswald or his wife. That was probably also true for most of the other recently returned defectors. CIA asset George DeMorenschildt apparently helped Oswald get the job at the U2 map firm to make him more attractive for the Russians to recruit. Because Oswald was working for Naval Intelligence and had some CIA role, Helms and the agency used that justification to essentially lie to the Warren Commission and congressional investigators about debriefing Oswald, and, as Newman learned, about other matters as well. However, just as it had in Russia, the KGB saw through the ruse of having Oswald work at the U2 map firm and made no contact with Oswald. Perhaps the KGB noticed what stands out today when we look back at Oswald's activities once he returned to the United States. That Oswald avoided real American communists, Marxists, and socialists like the plague, even though he could have easily found them around the colleges and hipper parts of New Orleans and Dallas. That Oswald was willing to contact such people and organizations only by mail smacks of building a cover for himself by leaving a paper trail at the direction of his handlers. That's especially true when we consider that his best friend in Dallas was the staunchly anti-communist George DeMorenschildt, and that Oswald would soon find himself working for two men who were stridently anti-communist and anti-Castro. By early 1963, Oswald was no doubt looking for another assignment. Ironically, buried in the 26 Warren volumes are Oswald's own notes for his big reveal, in which he admits hating communism, something he could publicly proclaim only after the success of his anti-Castro work, when he emerged from his deep undercover work to hoped-for fame and fortune. After being fired from his job at the MAP firm on April 6, Oswald made a well-documented move to New Orleans on April 24, 1963. He left Marina in Dallas and went to live with his uncle Dutz Murat, a bookie for Carlos Marcello. However, even before his move to the Crescent City, an INS agent interviewed Oswald in the New Orleans jail. The interview had to have been in February or March, and before Oswald's move and even before he lost his job, because the INS agent was transferred away from New Orleans on April 1, 1963. The INS agent didn't recall why Oswald was in jail, but the charge, if any, must have been minor, since no record of it was kept. During the interview, Oswald, probably using a Hispanic-sounding alias, pretended to be a Cuban national, even though he couldn't speak Spanish. It sounds absurd, except that Oswald would soon join, by mail, the tiny national pro-Castro organization known as the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, a group that the CIA had targeted for harassment and penetration since at least 1961. Also in early 1963, Oswald ordered through the mail the cheap rifle and pistol he would later be accused of using to kill JFK and Officer Tippit. Conveniently, Oswald had photos taken of himself holding each weapon, along with copies of two communist newspapers of opposing views, The Worker of the Communist Party USA, and the Trotskyite paper, The Militant. The late Dr. Philip Melanson, chairman of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, wrote that holding two such opposing papers would be like trying to present a coherent American political view by holding up copies of the conservative National Review and the liberal icon, The Nation. For any type of true believer, especially someone like Oswald, who had lived in Russia, it made no sense. However, here and throughout his life, all of Oswald's activities and claimed activities related to communism and Marxism are consistent with someone building and maintaining a cover, like his childhood idol who inspired I Led Three Lives. Who could have been directing Oswald's activities in 1963? It's well documented that a few months after his April move to New Orleans, Oswald worked at least part-time for and with two associates of Carlos Marcello, Marcello's private detective Guy Bannister and Marcello's pilot and investigator David Ferry. Both loom large in assassination literature, yet much of it ignores their connection to Carlos Marcello, who admitted to congressional investigators that he knew both men. Ferry had been an Eastern Airlines pilot who had known Oswald as a teenager when Ferry helped supervise Oswald's Civil Air Patrol unit. There is also some evidence that Ferry originally encouraged Oswald to join the Marines. By 1963, Ferry had lost his job at Eastern Airlines because he had been accused of molesting a 15-year-old boy. Ferry officially worked for Marcello's New Orleans attorney, but Marcello admitted working with Ferry directly on the two weekends prior to JFK's assassination. In addition, Victor Marchetti, former executive assistant to the deputy director of the CIA, confirmed that Ferry had been a contract agent to the agency in the early 60s, in some of the Cuban activities. Marchetti said that his boss, Richard Helms, stated that David Ferry was a CIA agent in the fall of 1963. According to historian Dr. Michael Kurtz, deputy chief of the New Orleans CIA station Hunter Leak confirmed Ferry's 1963 CIA work to him. Leak also confirmed that Guy Bannister performed work for the CIA related to Cuba. Bannister had many more and more highly placed intelligence connections than his associate David Ferry, and they developed before both men began working for Carlos Marcello. A former FBI chief of Chicago in the early 1950s, the hard-drinking Bannister had been assistant superintendent of the New Orleans Police Department for 2.5 years before being fired for erratic behavior caused by his drinking. Bannister then opened a detective agency, though he focused far more on intelligence work, strident anti-communism, and white supremacist causes than any traditional private detective. He maintained good relations with the New Orleans office of the FBI and with naval intelligence, as well as taking on work for the CIA, tasks that revolved around Cuba. The New Orleans States Item newspaper reported that Bannister participated in every anti-communist South and Central American revolution that came along, acting as a key liaison man for the U.S. government-sponsored anti-communist activities in Latin America. Bannister led his own group, the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean, which was involved in a plot against Fidel Castro in December 1960. 4 months earlier, when CIA mafia plots with Traficante and Marcello were in the planning stage, the CIA had considered Bannister for a covert assignment providing cover for a sensitive CIA operation. That job went instead to Howard Hughes' aide, Robert Mayhew, who only a few years earlier had been Bannister's partner, before Bannister went to New Orleans. Their other partner had been Carmine Bellino, by 1963 a close Kennedy aide in their fight against the mafia. While in the FBI in the 1930s, Bannister had even served on two cases with General Joseph Carroll, who in 1963 was heading the recently created Defense Intelligence Agency, which was supposed to oversee naval intelligence and the other military intelligence agencies. Bannister and Ferry are both said to have helped with the CIA's Bay of Pigs operation in early 1961, when New Orleans was a little-known site for one of the operation's Cuban exile training camps run by the CIA. On January 20, 1961, 3 months before the Bay of Pigs, one of Bannister's organizations even bought trucks in New Orleans for an anti-Castro operation using the name Oswald, a safe alias since the real Oswald was still in the Soviet Union. Bannister and Ferry's work on Cuban operations for the CIA continued into 1963, and by that summer, Oswald was working for them. When he was a student that year, Dr. Michael Kurtz actually saw Guy Bannister with Oswald at the University of New Orleans debating students about integration. In 1999, scholar and former Arizona Secretary of State Richard Mahoney published a book about John and Robert Kennedy, Sons and Brothers, after gaining special access to files at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library. Mahoney wrote that six witnesses saw Oswald with Ferry or Bannister in the summer of 1963, when Oswald garnered an unusual amount of TV, radio, and newspaper publicity for his phony one-man New Orleans chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Two witnesses said Oswald was working for Bannister at that time. Since that time, Kurtz has added another three people to the list of witnesses who saw Ferry and Bannister together, including Deputy New Orleans CIA Chief Hunter Leak. Leak said that not only did Ferry and Bannister work together, but that Lee Oswald did small jobs for the CIA as well. In fact, Leak said that he personally paid Oswald various sums of cash for his services. Kurtz later interviewed Richard Helms about this and other assertions. Helms was essentially the CIA's highest operational officer in 1963, and later became CIA director. Helms neither confirmed nor denied Leak's story when Kurtz asked Helms about it. Years later, a CIA-generated file card that linked Oswald to Bannister and Ferry was declassified. It said that in the CIA, there had been no secret as far as anyone was concerned in regard to the fact that Bannister and David William Ferry and subject Oswald may have known or been acquainted with one another. That was an understatement, but what happened to the CIA's extensive files in New Orleans about Oswald, Ferry, and Bannister is explained in a later chapter. Bannister and Ferry could have manipulated Oswald in a variety of ways. He always needed money, he had no car or driver's license, and he was stuck with a less-than-honorable discharge because of his defection. And he needed another intelligence assignment if he ever wanted to profit from a successful big reveal after his long years of undercover work. However, Congress was holding hearings about mail-order gun sales around the time Oswald ordered his guns through the mail, and hearings about the Fair Play for Cuba Committee around the time he started his one-man New Orleans chapter of that organization. So, the well-connected Bannister may have initially told Oswald that ordering guns and joining Fair Play for Cuba could help those hearings. It's also possible, even likely, given that at least nine people saw them together in New Orleans just months before JFK's murder, that Ferry and Bannister were helping to monitor Oswald for the CIA and naval intelligence. Someone was monitoring Oswald for naval intelligence, and doing so would put Bannister and Ferry in the perfect position to manipulate Oswald, who would think he was simply getting ready for his next intelligence assignment. In reality, though, Ferry and Bannister could have been controlling Oswald to set him up as the fall guy for the murder of President Kennedy. As we will find out, just a few months before Oswald ordered, or was told to order, the rifle and pistol, Carlos Marcello had made a threat to kill JFK to end RFK's prosecution of him. An FBI informant heard Marcello's threat and reported it to his contact at the Bureau, though that report has yet to surface in any released FBI files. The House Select Committee looked into the informant's account and concluded that the incident did occur. If Bannister and Ferry were manipulating Oswald for Marcello under the nose of the CIA and naval intelligence, this would resolve many of the lingering mysteries about Oswald's unusual activities in 1963. In August of that year, while being seen with Bannister and Ferry, Oswald received a surprising amount of TV, radio, and newspaper publicity from a fight Oswald provoked with a Cuban exile leader on the streets of New Orleans. The publicity Oswald secured seems highly unusual given how hard it was for left-wing groups to get any type of press coverage in the early 1960s in politically conservative states like Louisiana and Texas. When Oswald was arrested after the fight, an associate of Carlos Marcello bailed him out of jail. Oswald, Bannister, and Ferry did make one small mistake by using the address of a side entrance to Bannister's office building, 544 Camp Street, on some of the pro-Castro flyers that Oswald made a big show of distributing on the streets of New Orleans. The CIA had a media propaganda expert who easily could have arranged such publicity for Oswald. He was David Atlee Phillips, an expert in overthrowing Latin American governments for the CIA and a good friend to CIA officer E. Howard Hunt. In fact, Guy Bannister had met with Phillips a couple of years earlier about anti-Castro publicity. Remarkably, Phillips would also reportedly meet with Oswald and Cuban exile leader Antonio Veciana in Dallas in late August or early September to discuss killing Fidel Castro. Congressional investigator Gaetan Fonzi confirmed that meeting, as did my research associate in an interview with Veciana. It's important to note that Richard Helms was continuing the CIA mafia plots in 1963 without telling his own CIA director, John McCone, Robert Kennedy, or President Kennedy. Those plots included Marcello and Trafficante, as well as their confessed partner in JFK's murder, Johnny Rosselli, who also visited Guy Bannister that summer. Oswald's unusual adventures in Mexico City, David Atlee Phillips' primary base, though he did missions for Washington that didn't involve the Mexico City CIA station chief, can be explained the same way. Oswald spoke fluent Russian and poor Spanish, but after he visited the Russian and Cuban embassies in an attempt to get to Cuba, someone made calls in excellent Spanish and poor Russian that seemed designed to ensure that Oswald would not get permission to travel to Cuba. It was as if someone wanted him to stay in the United States so he could be of use to them later in the fall. Marcello had the means to make something like that happen. The Mexican Federal Police, DFS, helped the CIA monitor phone surveillance of the Russian and Cuban embassies. However, the DFS was corrupt and involved in the same heroin network used by Trafficante and Marcello. In addition, a CIA asset involved in the CIA mafia plots with Trafficante and Marcello had actually bugged a communist embassy in Mexico City for the CIA not long before, so he would have known much about the monitoring and debugging of communist embassies there. Oswald's exact actions on the day of the assassination are detailed in chapters 14 and 15. Here, we'll note that something important happened as soon as his name surfaced as a suspect. Naval intelligence staff in charge of monitoring secret surveillance reports on Oswald began destroying their files on him. My naval intelligence source was called back to his office in Washington and ordered to sanitize and destroy much of their Oswald surveillance file. That destruction continued until midday Sunday, November 24, and confirmation for that can be found in an FBI memo from several months later. In it, FBI agent T.N. Goebel stated that three of Oswald's fellow Marines said they had been interviewed about Oswald. However, Goebel noted that no such statements or interview reports had been located in Oswald's Marine or Office of Naval Intelligence files provided to the FBI. In a postscript for the FBI headquarters file, Goebel did not suggest any doubt that such interviews had taken place. Their absence from USMC and ONI files indicates that perhaps they have been destroyed. However, the destruction of files ended after Washington received word that Oswald had been killed. Since no trial lay ahead, the rest of the records wouldn't have to be destroyed, just hidden from the prying eyes of other agencies. Longtime researcher Paul Hoke, who has assisted several of the government's JFK investigations, later found indications in declassified government memos that there were more naval intelligence files on Oswald than were provided to the Warren Commission. He found references to three files, as well as a supplemental file on Oswald, one that was never explained or provided to any government committee. After Jack Ruby murdered Oswald, and it was clear there would be no trial, Naval Intelligence and Marine Intelligence decided to conduct their own secret investigation of Oswald. To maintain strict secrecy, even within Naval Intelligence, they used the same men who had been compiling the tight surveillance of Oswald, including my confidential source. The investigation began on November 24, 1963, immediately after Oswald's death, and lasted for 6 weeks. Given that Oswald had been under top-secret surveillance by Naval Intelligence, it's not surprising that the organization wanted to know how he could have been involved in JFK's murder. Even without a trial, if word ever leaked to the press or public about Oswald's intelligence work or the tight surveillance, it would have been a public relations nightmare for military intelligence and for agencies such as the CIA that had assisted with Oswald's surveillance. Military intelligence leaders would have to be ready with as many facts as possible in case President Johnson or congressional leaders called them to account. The military investigation was highly secret, even within naval and marine intelligence circles, and all of the investigators had to sign strict confidentiality agreements that threatened them with court-martial for any disclosure. No word leaked about the military investigation at the time, and the Warren Commission was never told about it. In 1978, the wife of a military navigator who helped fly the investigators to their destinations finally tipped off the House Select Committee on Assassinations about the secret military investigation of Oswald. When the former Marine navigator testified to House Committee staff, he confirmed his participation in the military investigation and provided committee staff with a great deal of specific information about his former commanders, the size of the investigation force, and their travel while they probed Oswald's history. However, as recounted in the House Committee's report, when congressional staff tried to run down those leads, Defense Department officials stonewalled them until the committee's term was almost over. The first piece of official confirmation for the existence of the military investigation was provided only when the committee's efforts were ending. The committee never received the military's findings or report. However, the former Marine navigator had read the military's report and testified that it concluded that one person was incapable of committing the assassination alone. My naval intelligence source, who worked on the investigation, provided more detail, saying that the military intelligence report concluded that Oswald was not the shooter due to his skills, the gun, etc., and that the report stressed that Oswald was incapable of masterminding the assassination or of doing the actual shooting. I later located an additional independent ex-Navy source who confirmed the report's existence and its conclusion that Oswald was not the shooter and was incapable of masterminding the assassination. This confidential ex-Navy source was the son of an admiral who, thanks to his father's high position, had been assigned to a comfortable office job at a major U.S. naval base in the Pacific. While handling files, he noticed the report and, intrigued, read the entire file. He told me that the report was probably being kept so far from Washington to ensure that word of it didn't leak, and so it wasn't seen by civilian political officials who might talk to journalists. These conclusions meshed with off-the-record comments of U.S. officials who expressed doubts about the evidence against Oswald in private conversations, even as they publicly proclaimed his ironclad guilt. These comments came from the highest levels of government, as shown by a private taped conversation between President Lyndon Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover soon after the assassination. In the call, Hoover admitted to Johnson that the evidence against Oswald is not very strong. At the same time, Hoover was pushing Oswald's guilt to journalists, the public, and other officials. Years later, Dallas Police Chief Jeff Curry, who had been in JFK's motorcade, was blunt in his assessment of the lack of real evidence against Oswald. "We don't have any proof that Oswald fired the rifle and never did. Nobody's yet been able to put him in that building with a gun in his hand." Right after JFK's murder, Curry's public statements, like Hoover's, had shown no such doubt. But to himself at the time and in public years later, Curry admitted that he thought Oswald had been trained in interrogation techniques and resisting interrogation, and that Oswald was some type of agent. In hindsight, it's easy to see why the public initially accepted the reassuring public pronouncements of Hoover, Curry, and other officials that a communist lone nut had killed JFK. After all, it was the height of the Cold War. Then, too, on the surface, Oswald looked guilty. He had a job along the motorcade route. He'd left the building after the assassination. He was a member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and he appeared guilty of the murder of Officer J.D. Tippit. However, as has been well documented since the publication in 1966 and 1967 of the first critical analyses of the Warren Commission's own 26 volumes of supporting materials, the evidence fails to support the Commission's most important claims about Oswald's guilt. For example, other employees also left the building after the shooting. Oswald had no getaway car or even a driver's license, and initially left by public transit bus, and he had only $13.87 in his pocket when he was arrested at the Texas Theater. More important, as Police Chief Curry said, there was no credible evidence to place Oswald in the book depository's sixth-floor sniper's nest. In contrast, much compelling evidence, including testimony from the Warren Commission volumes, places him in the depository's lunchroom at the time of the shooting, near a payphone, as if waiting to receive or make a call. As detailed later, all the evidence and eyewitness testimony against Oswald in Dealey Plaza and the Tippit case are very problematic and far from conclusive, while Oswald's actions at the Texas Theater, where he was arrested, smack of someone trying to locate a prearranged contact. In fact, John Martino, a mobster associate of Marcello and Traficante, confided to a friend that Oswald was to meet his contact at the Texas Theater. They were to meet Oswald in the theater and get him out of the country. When we look at Oswald in isolation as a suspect in JFK's murder, he can appear unusual. However, as noted earlier and as will be detailed in later chapters, Dallas wasn't the only city where the Godfathers planned to kill JFK, and Oswald wasn't the only ex-Marine arrested and investigated for trying to kill JFK. In Chicago, Thomas Valley, a seemingly troubled former Marine, was arrested on November 2, 1963, on the morning of JFK's planned motorcade through that city. As people started to line the streets in anticipation of seeing JFK, the motorcade was suddenly called off, with two different phony excuses hurriedly given, because the Secret Service had learned that four possible assassins were at large. When arrested, Valley had an M1 rifle, a handgun, and 3,000 rounds of ammunition in his car, according to the House Select Committee. In interesting parallels with Oswald in Dallas, Valley had recently taken a job in a warehouse overlooking JFK's Chicago motorcade route, had moved into a YMCA in the fall of 1963 around the same time as Oswald, and had contact with a CIA-supported anti-Castro Cuban exile group, as had Oswald earlier in 1963. For the attempts to kill JFK in Tampa on November 18, 1963, there were even more parallels between Oswald and Gilberto Lopez, a young man living there at the time. On the day of JFK's Tampa motorcade, Lopez was working not far from the motorcade route. Oswald and Lopez were about the same age and had the same general physical description. The description of a suspect issued in Tampa prior to the attempt to kill JFK in that city fits Oswald and Lopez much better than the initial description issued by the police in Dallas after JFK was shot. In all, government files and sources show there were 19 parallels between the two men, including having highly unusual ties to the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, getting into fistfights over seeming pro-Castro sympathies, making an unusual trip to Mexico City to try to get into Cuba, not owning a car or even being able to drive, and moving to a new city and leaving a wife at the same time, just a few months before JFK's assassination. After the attempt to kill JFK in Tampa was called off and JFK successfully completed his motorcade, Lopez left Traficante's home base and reportedly went to Dallas, which was in Marcello's territory. Lopez would be secretly investigated for JFK's murder by both the FBI and the CIA, and their reports on Lopez were provided to Naval Intelligence. Had JFK been killed on November 2, 1963, in Chicago, home of Rosselli's mob family, or in Traficante's base of Tampa on November 18, 1963, Someone remarkably like Oswald was apparently positioned to take the fall in either of those cities, just like Oswald in Dallas. The conspirators had only one basic plan, to shoot JFK in an open motorcade, a plan that could be applied in all three cities. Aside from someone to take the blame, the other personnel were mostly the same, regardless of which city would be the scene of the assassination. For example, Jack Ruby, part of Marcello's organization in Dallas, had well-documented ties to his hometown of Chicago, where he received a large payoff shortly before the attempt to kill JFK there, and also to Tampa. Oswald had been a mystery to many on all sides of the JFK assassination controversy, but when looked at through the lens of Carlos Marcello and his associates, and that of U.S. intelligence, his documented actions as they unfold in this book finally make sense. The only viable explanation for why Oswald worked for strident anti-Castro anti-communists like Bannister and Ferry and was friends with anti-communist George de Morenschild is that he was an anti-communist U.S. intelligence asset. Many liberals in the early 1960s, including JFK, were anti-communist, so such a role didn't require Oswald to be as ultra-conservative as Bannister and Ferry. In that role, he was one of several U.S. intelligence assets sent to the Soviet Union to come back to America with a Russian wife. When the KGB failed to take the bait in the U.S., Oswald soon began focusing on an upcoming anti-Castro Cuban operation for naval intelligence and/or the CIA. Meanwhile, intelligence assets Bannister and Ferry began to manipulate Oswald for non-intelligence reasons. Both were also working for Carlos Marcello, who was planning to kill President Kennedy to end Robert Kennedy's war against the Godfather and his mob allies. Oswald would have been focused on what he thought was his impending mission to Cuba and his big reveal when he would finally emerge from years of undercover work to fame and fortune. Yet the very actions that helped him build a pro-Castro, pro-communist image in public for his intelligence work would also make him look instantly guilty if he were ever accused of murdering the president. Confessed conspirator John Martino, an associate of Marcello and Traficante, described the tragic scenario perfectly, telling a trusted associate that Oswald didn't know what he was involved in or who he was really working for. He was just ignorant of who was really putting him together. Chapter 3. A Mafia Godfather Confesses. On December 15, 1987, Godfather Carlos Marcello sat in a gazebo in a prison yard with two close associates as he railed against John and Robert Kennedy. Aside from those two, no one was in earshot as he hurled curses at the long-dead Kennedy brothers. He had done that before, but this time, since Marcello trusted the two men, he went further than usual in his anti-Kennedy tirade. Normally, in careful control of his emotions, Marcello became more and more agitated as he talked about the Kennedys' crusade against him. First, they'd hauled him before Congress, then briefly deported him to Central America, and finally, they had him prosecuted in New Orleans, the center of his multi-state criminal empire. Marcello's anti-Kennedy rant reached a crescendo as he blurted out to his two friends a startling admission about John F. Kennedy. "Yeah, I had the son of a bitch killed. I'm glad I did." Marcello's only regret seemed to be that he didn't get to pull the trigger, since he told his two stunned associates, "I'm sorry I couldn't have done it myself." Carlos Marcello had become America's most powerful godfather by being not just ruthless, but also cautious and discreet. And he paused his diatribe after his remarkable confession, realizing that even though he trusted his two associates, he had crossed a line. Marcello turned away from them and simply walked off. After Marcello left, his deadly admission hung in the air between the two stunned men who'd heard it. They knew Marcello well enough to know what could happen to them if they ever revealed what they'd just heard. One man told the other, "I don't know about you, but I did not hear anything." With that, he walked away as well, leaving 56-year-old Jack Van Lanningham alone in the prison yard's gazebo to ponder the gravity of his situation.